Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, executive editor.
Hi, everyone.
Well, Mara, lots of big casting news to talk about today. Camila Bannis, who has played Daze's Gabby since 2010, has opted to leave the show. So she filmed her last episode on April 28th, but with the production schedule at Daze, she's going to air into the fall. So we have about 6 more months, if not more, of Gabby and of Stefan and Gabby. Now, in an interview with The Wrap, Camila said that with the changes at the show, including its move to Peacock last year, she saw it as a sign to maybe start the next chapter of her own life. She also indicated that she was willing to stay, but couldn't come to terms, saying she was open to negotiating a shooting schedule where she would have maybe some more time off, but they didn't go for it. So we will be saying goodbye to Gabby. Now, in other day's news, Emmy winner Kate Mancey, who played Abigail Devereaux on and off since 2011, has been tapped to replace Emmy winner Lexi Ainsworth as Christina Corinthos Davis on General Hospital.
I think that safely falls under the category of casting shockers. So Kate is a powerhouse actress. There is no question about that. But I think it just generally came as a huge surprise to us that GH was recasting this particular role because Lexi has played Christina on and off since she was 16 years old. And that always forges a tight bond between viewers and actress. Christina is, I think, a character that so much can be done with. You know, obviously she's positioned within two important families because she's the daughter of Alexis and Sonny, which makes Sam and Molly her siblings on the Davis side and Michael and Dante, her brothers, on the Corintho side. And in a few years, it may be more relevant to story that she also has Avery and Donna as sisters via her dad. But I think fans have been loudly asking for bigger and more story for her for a long time. I have to imagine that the show has big story plans for Kate, who obviously has done incredible work in this genre.
I mean, I am certainly looking forward to seeing what they're going to do with her. I feel, as you said, people have been wanting this character to have a story, so it appears she is finally going to get one. Now, on the return front, here is a tune-in alert for Shamar Moore's Young and Restless comeback as Malcolm Winters. So the actor will reprise the role on May 8th for a planned tribute to the late Neil, who was played by the late Christoph St. John. So I was a big fan of Criminal Minds, and I am a regular viewer of SWAT, which are Shamar's primetime credits, and I so appreciate that he comes back to Y&R for special Winters family moments. You know, there are certainly a handful of stars that we could add to the list of people who are cool with talking about their soap days. Julianne Moore comes to mind first and foremost for returning to As the World Turns in their final chapter. And the late Ray Liotta was always up for a discussion about Another World's Joey Perini. But there's really the other side of it where actors leave daytime, become big stars, and then don't want to even acknowledge that they were ever on a soap. You know, like as though there's something to be ashamed of. I mean, daytime actors work so hard, learning lines, producing multiple episodes a day, a week, a month, a year. I mean, how many times have we done an interview with an alum who said they worked on a primetime show where they maybe got through like 3 pages of the script in one day? And I mean, on a soap, that would be like, I don't know, an hour in the morning, you know?
Absolutely, 100%. And how many times have we heard about big name actors from primetime and movies who were hired to do a soap and struggle? You know, it's not an easy gig. Gregory Harrison, who plays GH's Gregory, when we had him on the podcast, he not only was candid about how terrified he was about whether he could handle the workload, he made it very clear how hard he works to commit so many scripts to memory, you know, over and over and over again. I've always thought that because of how demanding the workload is and how quickly they shoot, which, you know, has to come at the sacrifice of rehearsal time and extra takes, if you shine in this genre, as far as I'm concerned, you're more impressive to me than someone who gives a great performance on Broadway after months of rehearsal or gives a great performance in a movie after rehearsal and multiple takes. But I really do love how much love Shamar has for YNR and for its audience. You know, he not only got his start there and really developed his skill set as an actor there, but I really think that he understands and appreciates that the YNR fans were his first mega fans, you know, like their love and their support helped make him a star. And I think it speaks volumes about his character that he is down to make these occasional visits. And speaking of visits, I have to give a shout out to Constance Towers, who GH fans saw this week on air as a hallucination of the late Helena Cassidine. James Patrick Stewart, who plays her son, Valentine, joked to me that he knows whenever he sees her name on the call sheet, it's going to be a very bad day for Valentine. And he certainly wasn't wrong, given that Valentine was on the verge of death, thanks to the pathogen. But bravo to Constance for such a deliciously wicked performance. She is a legend, and she proved it again this week, if you ask me.
Well, hear, hear to all your points. I could not agree more. Now, our guest today is in the thick of some big drama on Bold and Beautiful. It's Annika Noel, who plays Hope and hasn't been a guest on the podcast since 2019. So let's check in and see how the past 4 years have gone. Hi, Annika.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I am doing so well. Thank you so much for having me. It is so good to chat with both of you again. It's been a second. It's been a while.
It really has. It has been 4 years almost, which is crazy. But we did speak to you after the big Baby Beth storyline. And it almost feels like that was so long ago because yeah, it really was. Totally. But also there's so much to cover since then. Something else that we noticed when we went back to listen to that podcast was that we never did anything about your history. So we didn't get to learn about how Annika Noel came to Hollywood. So we're going to start back in the beginning. So you hail from the Boston area and Christmas literally came early for your parents when you were born on Christmas Eve. So tell us what you were like as a little girl.
Well, I think my mom wishes that Christmas hadn't come early because I was 2 weeks late and apparently put her through it. So, I think, but you know, there's still the once a year conversation where it's like, you're the best Christmas present ever, God, for my mom. So I love you, mom. Shout out to you. Yeah, I honestly, if you really want to get into the history of me, Annika Noel, and how I came to be an actor, you could say I started young. Because the story goes, as my mom tells it, I came out fully formed, with a very thick, long set of eyelashes on me, where everyone was just talking about my eyelashes and all that kind of stuff. And I don't want to toot my own horn, but they basically were like, does your baby want to be in a commercial? And because of, you know, I guess the impression I made upon my arrival, I suddenly, a few months later, was in a commercial as a newborn for the hospital, and the new maternity wing. So yeah, I got started early. And I still have that check. My dad was really sweet, and he framed that very first check from 1986, my first paycheck as an actor, and he framed it for me. And I still have it here.
That is so cute.
That's amazing.
Well, here I was thinking that you had made your acting debut as a three-toed sloth in a preschool production of the great how do you pronounce this? K-pop?
I think
K-pop tree.
Yeah, the great K-pop tree. And first of all, okay, you did your research. props to you. That was indeed my first actual taste of the stage, if you will. and it had such an impression on me as a child. And also that story is a great story. I highly recommend that book. It is an illustrated book and it teaches us the importance of conservation and protecting the rainforest. But yeah, I was a three-toed sloth, probably the hottest costume I've ever been in wardrobe-wise. but it was so fun, and it definitely set the pace for, you know, my creativity and what I love to do and my passions as a young girl. And then, you know, growing up, I grew up in the suburbs of Boston. Can I say I'm a little masshole with pride, with spirit?
You can say it.
I'm a little masshole. I'm proud of it. I love that city. I love that state. And yeah, it just every year I would always be jumping to do the theatrical production, whatever the musical was, whatever I could do to be on stage and be in front of people performing. I took off running, and mm-hmm. I still love every second of it. I miss the stage, actually. I miss performing for a live audience, but soaps are kind of the closest thing you can get to that.
Oh, absolutely. Now, you were in high school when you really set your mind on pursuing acting professionally. So how did you come to that decision, and what did your family think about it?
My high school, again, and also I went to an all-girls school. So I would be lying if I didn't say some of the reasons for wanting to do the productions was also because it was with our brother school. And that was the one chance you kind of got to interact. So, you know, I did a various Sound of Music, Bat Boy, Sweet Charity. I played Rosalind in As You Like It, which is actually something I'm still very proud of to this day, doing that as a sophomore in high school. So I was in AP US History, and we watched a documentary about the Great Depression and the impact that talkies and movie theaters had on and people's experience, and how, you know, just those 25 cents that they saved to go to a movie theater would kind of take them out of what was going on in their lives at the time, and the impression that it had. And I just remember this one old man in this documentary that we watched talking about the women's dresses. And how if he could just see those women's dresses and those dance numbers, and how it would just take him out of the difficulties he was experiencing in his life. So that's when I made the decision that, you know, if I can use my vulnerability and my empathy to allow other people to feel something, to take them out of whatever situation that they're going on in their life, or maybe even illuminate certain things in their lives. Cause I can tell you three films immediately that had such a huge impact on my life. E.T., Cried Hysterically, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, like just changing my worldviews. So I wanted to be a part of that. And if I could do that, I knew the risk that it would entail of, you know, maybe I'd be a waitress for the rest of my life, but it was a risk I was willing to take. And my family was incredibly supportive. They just wanted me to have a college degree. So that was very important to them. So I applied to a bunch of theater schools and wound up going to UCLA's Theater, Film, and Television School. And I've been hitting the road and hitting the pavement, trying my best to make it ever since. So yeah.
Wait, I might not sleep tonight. What's the third movie? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and what?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, E.T., and this one is also on my top films of all time. Finding Nemo, I thought was just absolutely beautiful. Yeah, and then we could get into, I mean, I'm a film buff, I'm a history buff, Gilda, just Once Upon a Time in the West. Like I could go on and on about classic Hollywood cinema and the influence and impact it had on me. Singing in the Rain, that was another one that just Gene Kelly was such a huge influence on me. Audrey Hepburn, Roman Holiday, Katharine Hepburn, Rita Hayworth. Like I could go on and on.
It's something I like it.
I'm very passionate about it.
Well, I'm curious to know what it was like for a Massachusetts born and bred gal such as yourself to suddenly be on the West Coast. Like, was that a big culture shock for you at that age?
Absolutely. I say it took me over a decade to learn how to tolerate it. Because it's not New England. It's not, but that's also my Boston. That's my Boston pride. No, California is such a beautiful state. My only gripe when I first got here was just people walk slow. And that was something that was very hard for me. I'm a fast sidewalk walker, if you will. Get out of my way. I'm coming through. I have places to be, people to see, things to do. So I will say, you know, now that I've been out here, I've been away from the mothership, as I like to call it. I've been away for a while. I have learned to be kind of more present, a little more patient, taking it easy, if you will. But yeah, it definitely was a culture shock. But I still can be that sarcastic, you know, blunt East Coaster. And everyone's like, you don't sound like you're from Boston. I'm like, just get me in a car. Get me in a car. Find out real fast. You'll find out fast.
Now, when you were at school, were you pursuing acting jobs or were you really focused just on getting your degree at that time?
No. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't know if this has changed, but at the time, there was a policy where you could not do outside work. They really wanted your focus to be on the program. And that, you know, that's where your passion or not passion, but that's where your focus needed to be. I think that actually puts the students at a disadvantage because you need to be building that resume. You need to be making those connections as soon as you land out here. So I don't know if that's changed. I know actually some people left the program because they did actually book outside work and they wound up not being able to manage it. We actually had the least amount, or sorry, we had the most credit requirements out of any major at UCLA aside from engineering. Engineering was the only one above us that had the most credit requirements. So it was a very strenuous program because it was also a BA, which was very important to me to also get a general education and to be taking classes outside of theater, outside of the arts, because I do think that's how you have a more balanced worldview and more knowledge that will inform your characters. If you learn other subjects and you learn other, I mean, how are you going to play a doctor if you don't know the first thing about anatomy? I mean, I think it was a wonderful experience to obtain a lot of classical theater knowledge, to learn the history of theater, to understand the different schools, Meisner, Uta Hagen, Stanislavski, Strauss, you know, just all of that as a base. And then the main thing I would say going forward from that is you have to start trusting yourself as an actor and taking all those little bits and pieces and everything you learn to create kind of what works best for you and what is brings truth and genuine storytelling for yourself. So yeah. And then I did the first ever showcase for the undergrads and got in trouble for it. Yeah, I've always kind of been a little bit of a rebel, but at the time they, for some reason, were only doing showcases for the grad students and they weren't doing it for the undergrads. And little Miss Annika went and did it anyway. But I was very proud to say a lot of people did get agents and work out of that. So
hey now, good for you.
Yeah, that's absolutely awesome.
And, so, and to answer your question, I'm sorry, I was very lucky. The two productions I actually wound up being a part of, one wound up going to the Geffen Playhouse and was there. And then the other one, my dear friend, Kit Steinkellner, who is just one of the most amazing writers that I have ever had the honor of working with. She won Best Original Play at the Kennedy Center, and we got to perform at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. So I got very lucky.
That's amazing.
That I happened to be a part of.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Okay, so you finish school and you're making that transition into the real world and trying to, you know, establish yourself in the entertainment industry. So did you, like, what kind of day jobs did you have to help pay the bills along the way?
Oh, I had a bunch of fun things. Oh, let's see. When I could handle being around people, I was a bartender. I was a hostess, cocktail waitress. And then when I got tired of people, then I would go be a paralegal for a little while in personal injury law. And then once I was tired of being on my own in an office, just looking at books all day, then I'd go back to being a waitress and a hostess. And honestly, the best job I ever had as a struggling actor was a host at Bledsoe's Barbecue. best job. They supported us. They didn't give us a hard time if we had to call out for getting auditions, as long as we got our ship covered. And then they sent us home with a bunch of food at the end of the night because they make their food fresh daily. And so that was one of the best jobs I had as a struggling actor. And shout out to Bledsoes. It was a wonderful job. And I honestly still go back to visit them and say hi. And yeah, they're just great people there.
Awesome. I love that. Now you did do a string of national commercials, including ones for Geico and Dairy Queen. So tell us about your experiences on the sets of those.
Well, I will say by no means was it easy climbing the ladder. I'd say, to answer your question a little while back, I started doing extra work. So I started doing extra work. I earned my SAG cards through that. Then I was looking for like student thesis films to get material for a reel. And then, you know, eventually I got an agent, and then eventually that led to more. And then eventually, you know, I managed to do the national commercials, which were so much fun, because do many people know, I actually was at Groundlings School in Theater, and I thought I was going to be on a sitcom. I didn't think, you know, like comedy, improv, that was my happy place. That was my, you know, I made it all the way up through Writer's Lab there. That was my, I don't know, where I could experiment, explore, you know, again, being witty, fast with the comebacks. And then all of a sudden I found this kind of niche, if you will, of national commercials that were kind of comedically based. And I think I got very lucky and was very honored to work on those. And they let us kind of do improv sometimes on set, and you get to have a blast. And, you know, the line with me and the rabbit, that's just something that came out at that time of like, you know, for that commercial where I got to be Sleeping Beauty. And so it was wonderful. It was a wonderful way to finally earn a living as an actor. So one of the first things that allowed me to qualify for health insurance, which is huge, and get to flex those muscles and be on a set, be on a professional set, and get to work with, you know, a lot of those directors do huge things outside of commercials. So it was just a really magical experience. And honestly, I'm still trying to book them. They're great. They're great jobs if you can get them. They're wonderful. I mean, look at Tanner, Liberty Bibberty.
Right,
I mean,
right.
He gets it. We know.
Although I feel like your Dairy Queen commercial was still airing when you started at B&B, because there was like Valentine themed, and you started in January, and then it was airing in February.
First of all, you're so good. You guys, props to you. You did your research. That commercial was the gift that kept on giving. It played for many years. And again, it allowed me to earn a living and to qualify for health insurance, and really was some of the first work I did as an actor that I could sustain myself financially. So yeah, and that was great. And I'm still in touch with the actor that I worked on that with. And yeah, he's a great guy. So yeah. And actually and then there was an Infinity commercial. I still stay in touch with Tate from that. Like, yeah. So, it was just a wonderful playground to learn, to absorb, to also be trusted with the freedom of your own artistic kind of talent. Like the fact that they're putting trust in me to, you know, have fun, riff for a little while, improv, like, and then using that for the commercial sometimes was just so, it was the first kind of arena where I learned to trust myself as an actor, and that like, hey, you actually do have something to offer here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very affirming in that way.
Yeah.
So I think this might've been a little bit prior, maybe it was sort of simultaneous, but I have to ask you about your appearance in the 2014 film adaptation of the musical Jersey Boys, directed by, you know, a somewhat well-known director, I suppose, Mr. Clint Eastwood. But I'm curious to know what the audition process was like for that role.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That is honestly, after that experience, I called my dad. I was like, I don't care what happens with the rest of my career as an actor. If nothing else happens, if nothing else works out, this experience alone, I fulfilled my dream. This was So the audition process for Jersey Boys, you know, I rehearsed it many times. I went in for the read, and the casting director later told me that the reason they liked my tape was because I was the one person who made the environment feel real, who brought the environment in. Cause I was like looking up at the church, you know, cause it was in a church where we have this scene, and like looking up at the walls, and didn't hear back after I auditioned for, I want to say over a month. So I was like, oh, well, okay. That would have been fun. And all of a sudden, a month later, I get a call from the casting associate, probably made him deaf. I screamed in his ears that I got it. And then followed up with, oh, and you'll also be singing live with the other actors who like originated some of these roles on Broadway. And meanwhile, I hadn't been given that theater opera. Like I'd been out of practice. I hadn't done musicals since high school. I was like, oh, is there time for practice? Like, it was very much like, no, you'll meet with the music director the day of and you'll rehearse. And so I just went into little actor study mode, put my little study cap on, rehearsed without, you know, outside, you rehearsed it every which way I could have so that I was prepared when I came into set that day. And then I came into set that day and it was just as magical as everyone talks about Clint's sets. I mean, he, as an actor coming from that world, creates a set and an environment that is so welcoming and is so respectful of the creative process for everyone involved. I mean, he's working with the same crew he's worked with for years. It is just a well-oiled machine. And to get to witness that and to get to be a part of it was such an honor, and to be directed by him. And then to get to sing with my fellow, you know, co-stars at that moment. And they really were, we recorded live. That's one of the first movie musicals since they kind of have this new life since the golden age of Hollywood musicals. They've kind of gotten a second wind ever since Chicago. This was one of the first ones where they recorded it live.
Amazing.
So it was just an honor. And, you know, the organ, and we were in this beautiful church in downtown LA and the acoustics were just unbelievable. It really was a dream come true. And it is definitely a feather in my cap. And I got to talk to Clint about golfing. So that was really wonderful.
Love that. Now I saw it in the theater, but there are a lot of, you know, you can catch it on streaming or on TV randomly. Like, have you ever caught yourself flipping channels? Like, have you caught the movie at all?
I know it's definitely, I think it's on HBO. I've caught it there. That's actually not the movie I've caught before.
Oh, which one is it?
I did a little something that you might see every now and then called True to the Game. And that one I've actually caught when I'm just scrolling. And my my partner, he's just like, stop, wait, aren't you in this? I'm like, no, we don't have to watch. He's like, no, it's okay. We don't need it. He's like, no, I want to. And it's so funny because that's a character that is, she is unlike Hope. Let's just say that. Unlike Hope. I have caught that one, but yeah, I mean, it's an honor. Like, wherever you can watch it, feel free to watch it. Feel free to enjoy. But that, and then I did also a Hallmark Love's Christmas Journey. That was actually my first real, actual acting job that wasn't a commercial. In Los Angeles was Love's Christmas Journey, and Sean Astin plays my father in it, and that was such an amazing experience because he comes from kind of Hollywood royalty, and to get to, he was first of all so welcoming and so kind and the sweetest man in the world, and then to get to hear his stories and to kind of pick his brain about how things work, and he really showed me the ropes. He's also a UCLA Bruin, and he was giving me the 411 about Seppi's sandwich shop and Diddy Reese asking me about Westwood and what it's still like. So yeah, that was an amazing experience.
It's also Rudy.
Rudy, yes. Absolutely. I mean, to me, I was coming from like Lord of the Rings.
Right, you know, right.
That kind of world. And now it's just, yeah, it just was, it's really wonderful. And it was actually one of the last projects that Ernest Borgnine worked on. And so I also met Greg Vaughn.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Greg Vaughn is the sheriff, I believe. So I actually, Greg, out of everyone in, Hillary Bailey Smith is obviously, but I was going to say, but that's one of the first people aside from Hillary that I met in soaps and have known ever since. Yeah.
So the audition for B&B came up in 2017, but had you auditioned for any soaps prior to that?
I don't know if I'm allowed to admit that, but yes. I had met with Mark quite a few times, Marnie, my fellow Massachusetts Red Sox. I just remember she had like a Red Sox mat and like a bunch of Red Sox. I was like, I'm home. I'm safe here. And then Mark, you know, Mark, you have to be on your toes because he's always off book. He's more off book than you are. and it was really sweet. He actually approached me after the Emmys one year and just said, you know, I'm happy someone snatched you up because they wouldn't call you back in for multiple roles if they weren't interested. Let's just say that if they weren't fans, because that's always the goal as an actor. You're not trying to book the role. I never think about it as trying to book, oh, I have to get this job, I have to get this role. For me, it was always making a good impression of the room. I wanted to book The Office. I wanted The Office to become fans of mine. So even if I wasn't right for this part, they might think of me later down the road for something else if it came up. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark is famous for that. And I'm sure you would have gotten the call back, you know, by GH if B&B beat them to the chase, as they say.
True that. I feel like we could have the drinking game on this podcast for however time, well, any time that Mark Teschner or Marnie Saida are called out in a discussion, people would be drunk by the end.
I would be remiss. So I got to call out our lovely casting associates as well, because they took a dark brunette that everyone was like, I don't know, she's a brunette. And I was the only brunette in the room and they believed in me and they saw something in me. So I have to give them a shout out.
Of course, definitely.
They changed my life for the better. So thank you to B&B Casting. I love you both so much.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, your mom was a soap fan when you were growing up. Is that correct? And had you ever gotten into them yourself?
She was. I just remember coming home from school and it was usually, was it One Life to Live or All My Children and then General Hospital as well, I think. And then Oprah. Oprah was a big staple as well. I know she's not a soap, but that was a big staple in my household growing up. And so she watched the stories and Maurice, if you're out there, if you're listening, I may have had a bit of a crush on you when I was younger. Because it's Sunny, right? Sunny.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Had a thing for the bad boys even back then.
Did I text him? Tell him.
Sorry. But yeah, I do remember having a bit of a crush on him.
And who didn't?
I mean, right? Like, yeah. And this, it's just, the storytelling is so rich and so good. And honestly, I fully put all my chest into saying this and all my weight behind this. Daytime has some of the best actors in this entire industry. I think, unfortunately, we often get overlooked and underappreciated, but I really truly and strongly believe some of the best performers are right here in daytime doing the unthinkable in just one take, in just one take, and getting it done. So
could not agree more. Hear, hear.
Yeah.
So when you first came in, the show was being rather hush hush about the fact that it was the role of Hope that they were looking to cast. And you went in thinking you were auditioning for a character named Jennifer. So I think there were like 12 contenders for the role of Hope that you were in the room with initially. Obviously, you as a brunette, as you mentioned, they saw it in you. But did you have any misgivings about having to go blonde?
Yes. I had never dyed my hair before. And honestly, if you look at some of the first year or so, my hair was a little damaged. It was I was fighting the flyaways a little bit. It's a very intimidating process. You're sitting on the couch, you're looking at these other, you know, picture perfect little petite blondes that are like Kim Matula lookalikes. And you're just like, well, I don't stand a chance. Like this, there's no way. And again, from my own deduction in the scenes where they had me talking a lot about gondolas, I was like, maybe it's this role, maybe it's for this. And so then I did my research and kind of looked at a lot of YouTube clips and and the history of the character and all of the twists and turns and the twisted web that we weave on soaps. And then they kept calling me back. And then suddenly I was reading with Scott, and then suddenly I'm reading with Catherine. And each time there's just only blondes sitting on the couch next to me. And I just kept thinking like, oh, there's no way. But you, Brad and to everyone else in that room, all the executive producers casting, they saw something in me. And then I had to go blonde for Miss Hope. So yeah, I think we found a good balance now though. I mean, my hair was definitely angry in the beginning. It was not happy about going from dark, dark brunette with like never been dyed hair. But now I think we found the happy medium. I think we got there eventually. So yeah.
Your hair is great. Yeah. Now that was its own challenge, but did you find it challenging to come in as a recast for Hope in terms of, you know, wrapping your mind around everything she had done and all the relationships and her past?
I mean, it's definitely a challenge. Any actor that's a recast, there's a added level of complexity because whether you want it to or not, you're going to be compared. You don't have the freedom to originate a character. So you have to kind of have the confidence and the trust in yourself as an actor that you know what you're doing and you will bring truth to the character. And, you know, as long as you do your research and you understand this character's past and this character's history and what makes the character who they are, what has informed them to this point, you know, you'll be okay. Like, it's going to be okay. I know there was like a lot of worry initially because they're like, oh, well, she's not naturally blonde and she doesn't have bangs. And, you know, will they be able to accept her as Hope? And I think, you know, if you eventually just keep showing up as an artist and staying true to yourself and the character, like they eventually start to trust you. And yeah, I've been very lucky that I'm still continuing to fill those shoes, if you will. And I'm very lucky and I'm very honored that they gave me the chance to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, who were among your new castmates, the first people that you hit it off with?
Jackie, because of our love of animals. And we also enjoy a good drag bingo night, if you will.
Oh, I will.
Yeah. So, and you know, she had a rescued pity, and I used to work at the shelters in LA, and I love all my rescues, you know, adopt, don't shop. And so I think we really hit it off there. And she also is in the same kind of, you know, we're in the same age range. We play a lot, you know, bouncing off of each other. They usually pit Hope and Steffi against each other. So we're usually having to interact a lot. So yeah, I would say Jackie initially. Scott was also so warm and welcoming. John McCook, you know, he kind of shows you his dressing room and tells you all the stories of CBS Television City and all the amazing things that, and also, as we said, me as the film buff, as the history buff, like hearing, you know, Judy Garland walk these halls and Carol Burnett. I mean, it's just a dream come true. And then of course, Catherine Kelly Lang, my mama bear. She was so kind and gave me such great guidance in the beginning. It was a very warm, welcoming place when I first started, because it can be intimidating, especially mm-hmm. filling someone else's shoes. But because of how safe I felt and supported I felt on that set, you know, I kind of blossomed into the little actor I am today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say viewers really got a sense of just how gifted an actress you are when you carried the huge storyline of the Baby Beth switch. So looking back on that period of time and just that period of work, you know, do you feel like you changed at all as an actress just from the experience of playing such heavy emotional material on basically a daily basis for so many months?
Hey, where is that Beth? Where did she go? I would like to know, because I spent a lot of months crying about her. No, it absolutely did. I mean, we were talking a little earlier off the record, if you will, but I am not the same performer I was when I started. No soap actor is. No daytime actor is. You know, you start off kind of, I don't know, with your baby legs, your little fawn legs, where you're just getting the hang of things. And then you eventually find a rhythm and then you get stronger and then you, you know, kind of learn, your memorization gets better. I mean, it's like a otherworldly talent now, how quickly that I can memorize. I never thought I could do that in a million years. It used to be a longer process for me. But after a storyline like that, where it truly was a marathon, it definitely, I grew as an actor and as a performer with learning and understanding, I think, boundaries that I needed to set for myself in regard to mental health and taking care of yourself. Because if you aren't taking care of yourself, then you're going to have nothing to give in your performances. So that was a very important lesson that I learned in balance. Because, you know, I'm a little Miss Theater School. I want to give it my all. I, the craft is very important to me and bringing everything I can to a story and to a character. But by the end of it, I was just completely depleted and exhausted. And there wasn't really left much for myself at the end of that. And that was a lesson that I had to learn in my own personal life with still taking care of me so that I can bring my best side to what, so I can show up professionally, essentially. And I think that was a really important lesson to learn, and just learning also what I was capable of. You would laugh to know that I used to not, I used to get notes in school because accessing vulnerability was a very difficult thing for me as a performer. I was not the vulnerable little Miss Ingenue crying girl. That was not me. I was tough, rough around the edges. I could access anger very easily. That kind of darker, more complex character was kind of my maybe it was the brunette hair. I don't know. They dyed it blonde and now all of a sudden I'm crying over everything. But yeah, I actually really struggled with vulnerability and accessing that kind of part of my repertoire, if you will, that little spice cabinet that we all have as an actor and what we bring to a character. And so for me, it also taught me that I am capable. I can do it. This part where I thought I used to be very weak and wasn't a strength as an actor, turns out I actually can do it, and somewhat well, if I do say so myself. Yes,
indeed. I will say it too. You do.
So my personal belief is that every actor, when they're getting started in their careers, should find their footing in daytime, because nothing will teach you faster how to memorize, how to land a mark, how to access emotion so that you can be there and ready for one take. It truly has just allowed me to not only rise to the occasion, but meet it, learn from it, grow from it. And it has enriched me professionally in so many ways. And I'm just entirely grateful to be able to strengthen those muscles and to learn from some of the best in the biz.
Well, in 2020, obviously, real-world circumstances intervened and necessitated that B&B go on a production hiatus for a time. And when it resumed filming, the mannequin story soon followed. So I am so curious to know, Annika Noel, what was your reaction when you first heard about it?
Does that thing really look like me? Is that is that what I look like? That was my first. I was like, oh my god. Like, is that what I look like? we had to get creative. I mean, just the fact that we were on the first show to come back after COVID was such an honor. And we were all learning. We were all going through it. No one had been through anything like this before. We were all kind of just going, all right, well, how do we allow actors to be close to each other? How do we kind of navigate this minefield and all the challenges and difficulties that it brought about? And I think Bold and Beautiful rose to the occasion beautifully, and just the creativity and the wild. I mean, it was a wild storyline, but it was fun. It was fun. And then also just to get to be there and to watch Matthew Atkinson do beautiful work. I was just glad I could be a part of that storyline. And again, at that time, how lucky am I that I got I just happened to be on the show that was first back, and I was working as an actor, because that was a very scary time where none of us knew how the industry was going to shake out and what the industry was going to look like following that. So I'm glad I got to kind of be in the trenches with everyone else as we were all figuring it out. And I think we did so. And hopefully it was very entertaining along the way.
It absolutely was. But I mean, we have to ask, was it ever a challenge, you know, not to giggle just due to the somewhat outrageous nature of what you were playing?
No, actually, I would say for the James Corden Little Nas X skit with that was incredibly hard to keep a straight face for because of this, the improvising and having to be the straight person in the scene and not being able to do the comedy. I mean, that was very difficult because all I wanted to do was just to riff with them and to improvise, but I had to stick to my script. But this, it was very easy because I had to show up for Matt as a supportive co-star, and it was a very serious storyline. He took it very seriously, and I you know, it was important for me to be there for him and to have that honesty and that the genuine part of that story. That was important. It couldn't become a joke, because if it became a joke, then it becomes a mockery of that kind of situation. So I think it was very important to both of us to treat that storyline with respect and to treat it and to approach it with honesty and truth as much as we could. But I will say it was very fun to get to play Dark Hope, to get to play Mannequin Hope and to, right. and to kind of be that evil, you know, I changed my voice a little bit. That was fun. And then when they finally let her come to life and I got to use a lot of my dance background, because I actually danced for over 20 years when I was younger, to do some of the physicality and to have that challenge and that physicality. I mean, the little theater student in me was over the moon. I was having a blast. It was so much fun.
I love it. Now, Hope is now actually a mother of two, right? We've touched on Beth and Beth's confusing whereabouts, but we do see a lot of Douglas, who she adopted. So what has it been like for you to work with the now Emmy-nominated Henry Joseph Samiri as Douglas?
I am so happy for him. I am so proud. And honestly, we've watched him grow up. I mean, we've been with him as he's been growing up, and to get to see him also grow as an actor from when, you know, he'd get a few lines here and there, and now all of a sudden he knows our lines better than us. And he's like, that's not your line, Matt. Your line is this. And like, it has just been a hoot. I adore that boy. But yeah, to get to watch Henry grow up and take on these challenging storylines and just execute it with depth and with genuine emotion. And I'm in awe of him. He's such an intelligent, such a bright young boy. And I don't know, he is kind of like, in a way, he's my stage son. He's my TV son. And I do feel protective of him. I look out for him. He's a sweetheart. We have a lot of inside jokes. We talk music. We talk Pokemon. I mean, that is, I think, honestly, why he's featured as much as he is because he is that talented and he can do the work and he can do a monologue. He can do a scene that's 6 pages long. I mean, he is just so impressive. And I just can't wait to see where his career takes him from here. I think it's just going to be really beautiful, bright, amazing opportunities for him. And I'm just really excited for him and where that path is going to take him.
Couldn't agree more. Now, Sean Kanan's return in 2021 was good for Hope's storyline. Tell us about working with him and how you feel about having him there and Hope's dad being in the picture.
I absolutely adore him. He is also hilarious, and we have the same sense of sarcasm and humor. So it was immediate. It's like we're immediately giving each other a hard time. There was that immediate kind of, you know, father-daughter-esque bond and relationship. We also both studied martial arts. Fun fact, I studied Muay Thai, Jeet Kune Do, and Savate for a long time until some sports injuries took me out of it. So we both have that respect and appreciation for the martial arts and how it changed our lives. So we immediately already had that bond of like, hey, we both get this and we both love this and we both have this aspect of our life. And it basically launched a friendship, but he is angry with me, I will tell you, because I did introduce him to Bledsoe's barbecue. And he's just like, Annika, you wrecked my diet. How dare you introduce me to this great barbecue place? so he's a little mad at me about that. But as far as the father-daughter, I mean, it was the easiest. Not a thing is forced. I mean, it just is beautiful. And I'm so excited that, you know, especially with the storyline that's coming up, that Hope gets to be able to explore that relationship with her father. And it wasn't always easy and it wasn't always good. And he wasn't always doing the right thing. And you know, we all know Hope prides herself on that morality. And so to get to play a lot of those layers and I've had so much fun. It's so fun to get to play the history. Cause I wasn't there in the beginning to get to play those notes. So now that I get to finally do it, I'm having a blast with him and Catherine Kelly Ling, which I'm like, yeah, I'm team Deacon Brooke, by the way. I think that would be a lot of fun. That would definitely also ruffle Ridge's feathers a bit. And I think, Hope, whether subconsciously or not, that might be fun for her. So yeah,
absolutely.
It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Well, speaking of Sean, and as you mentioned, you had the amazing honor of working with James Corden and Lil Nas X in that sketch, which I have to say that came out at like 3 a.m. On YouTube, a night that I had insomnia. So I was among the first like 100 people to watch it. And when I realized this B&B aspect, I was freaking out in the middle of the night. But I feel like I saw you trying to suppress the laughter, which can honestly be forgiven because I don't know how you could have not been on the verge of cracking up. But it's such a hoot for people who haven't watched it. Highly recommend it. But were you so excited to have this opportunity?
Casey called me on my dark week, which is our week off, and was like, hey, would you be willing to come into work on Thursday? I was like, what? Like, it's my week off. Like, what are you really like? And then when he told me what it was for, I was like, when can I get there? I'll be there at 5 a.m. I'll be there. You don't even have to pay me. Like, I'll do whatever it takes to get to be like, I will do it. So I was so honored. I mean, honestly, I'm a fan of Lil Nas X. We actually have a friend, if you will, in common. We've both been directed by the same guy, Mike Diva, who I absolutely adore. He's actually directing for SNL right now. And he did a lot of Montero's music videos. And so I was like, you know, 1 degree of separation. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I just respect him as an artist and his messaging and what he's trying to say. And so that was just amazing to get to work with him, and then to work with James Corden on his last year was huge. And he is such a professional, and it was like watching a masterclass of him just setting up everyone for success. I mean, he would tee people up to make them look so great and to give them, he would give them the brilliant lines and to give them, you know, an opportunity to shine. And that's when, you know, the measure of a good host, of a good scene partner, is when it's not about them. It's not about their moment. It's about making their scene partners look good and being present and listening and giving that give and take. If someone's only thinking about themselves in that performance, it's worthless. It's not, you don't want to be acting with that person. That's not someone you want to be playing in the sandbox with. And to watch him at work and how quickly they move, and just, it was just so fun. And then on top of that, there's a delicate balance of they're filming a bit for Carpool Karaoke, where at the same time, we're also filming an actual genuine scene for Bold and Beautiful, and walking that line of filming both of those weren't filmed separately. That was something that we filmed for both of those things. So to watch them kind of create that balance, I mean, I hope they release a longer cut of his time on The Bold and the Beautiful, because the hilarious things that were said that did not get put into the take, there's so many jewels, so many gems that were in there. And yeah, keeping a straight face was the hardest part for sure.
That's amazing. Well, let's now delve into what you're doing now. So, you know, on paper, everything is going great for Hope. She's got Liam, she's got the kids, things are back on track with Hope for the future. So now, how do you understand the genesis of these sudden lusty feelings that she's harboring for Thomas?
I don't know what Hope's thinking. So that's also the beauty of soaps. You get the script a week before you film, not even a week before you film sometimes, and you don't know where the story's going. I know about, I want to say 3 to 3 weeks out ish. And even then they won't tell me stuff that they know, like where it's heading. Like, and I'll try to dig for little nuggets and they're like, no, we aren't telling you. So we're really along for the ride with the fans. And so for me, you know, that's also the beauty of daytime is, how do I justify this? How do I make this truthful for my character? How do I take whatever they throw my way and rise? I'm saying that a lot, but rise to the occasion. Like, how do I meet that and make it truthful and make it resonate? And so that's part of the fun part of being a daytime actor, is not only the speed at which you're getting all this new information, but also you have to make it true for your character and you have to justify it. And you have to find a way to make it genuine. And so for me, I've really been enjoying delving into more of Hope's history. I know we kind of touched on that with getting to work with Sean and Catherine Kelly Ling, but that's really been a lot for me of delving into the real root of the character and what makes her tick and kind of that genesis, like you said. And for me, the main thing has been control. Hope is very much a fan of control and needing to be in control, especially kind of growing up under the shadow or with the shadow of her mom and a lot of the judgment that was cast upon her mother that, you know, subconsciously or not, I think her character has inherited some of that. And so strongly, she just didn't want to be like her mom. And so much of her identity and so much of her kind of messaging that she's sending herself is not wanting to be like her mother. And, you know, to the point where if we're talking history, I mean, she had to have anxiety pills in order to have sex once upon a time. That was an actual story. And so that's been really fun for me, kind of dealing with those internalized thoughts of, and the judgments that honestly, if anyone is her own harshest critic, I think Hope is probably her harshest critic of herself. And that's why she's so, you know, strives for perfectionism, strives for that, you know, image of morality and control. And because, I don't know, I think it would be very interesting to see if she lets that grip loose a little bit and what results because of that. So I think, you know, the long-winded answer of how to justify, you know, how could she even be feeling this way after everything Thomas has put her family through? For me, Thomas is that forbidden fruit. And he encapsulates everything that Hope has not allowed herself in her own life, of that impulse, that act, you know, being reactionary, that, you know, kind of only thinking about yourself, not thinking about others and the repercussions of that. And you know, she tries so hard and is, I think, often, maybe too often, thinking of other people's needs and not so much of her own. And I think he fascinates her because he is kind of the polar opposite. He's like the opposite of control. He's kind of, you know, I know he's the reform bad boy now, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see. It's not something she's enjoying. I mean, she's fighting it with everything she has. She's horrified that she's feeling this way. She's like, what is wrong with me? Like, what is happening? Like, I'm not like I've always been Liam, you know, like Liam's the number one. And so I think she's just as horrified and honestly, more than anyone else, that she is feeling this way. So I'm curious to see where this takes her and what happens with her. So yeah, time will tell.
Do you play it and feel as though Hope truly believes that Thomas has changed and has done the work to become a better man?
I think there's always going to be that voice, like, fool me once, you know. There's always going to be that voice, that subconscious thing that's on the lookout. But Hope at her core, honestly, she gives people way too many chances. She is Miss Forgiveness, Miss Virtue. And I think that also aligns with who she holds herself up to be. And she does believe that people are capable of change. She does believe that people deserve second chances, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. I don't know. Ask Liam. I think that is part of her DNA and what makes Hope tick. So I genuinely, there's always going to be that thing of like, I know, and I'm got my alerts up, but she genuinely right now believes that he has turned over a new leaf. And it's allowed her to see, I think, different aspects of him that she maybe didn't allow herself to see before. Because not one person is all good or all bad. Uh-huh. Everyone has a mix. So, yeah.
Right. Well, there's friction between Hope and Steffi that seems to be deepening as this story unfolds. So for you, is it more fun to play scenes with Jackie Wood when your characters are getting along or when they're at odds?
I would say me, I'm not always a fan of when people pit women against each other or kind of force that scenario. So, but as an actor, conflict is always more interesting than everybody just getting along. So the actor in me is very happy to always pay, that's like theater 101, acting 101. When you're first taking classes, they go, what's the conflict of this scene? What's the conflict here? And that's always the dynamic is searching for that. And so, I think what's interesting this time around, it's not necessarily the two women being competitive over a guy. It's actually Steffi being protective of her brother. And feeling like he needs protecting from Hope of all people. And Hope's just going, what? Are you mad? Like, what? What are you talking about? So that I think is very interesting because we're playing more of the family dynamics and this mixed family, this blended family that they have and all this history that they have together. So I do think that's really interesting. And it's always, always fun getting to play in the sandbox with Jackie, if you will. She's so incredibly talented and a great scene partner. So yeah, I've been enjoying it.
I'm just going to say that as someone who has watched the show, like literally since the first day, I had a moment of like, oh my God, wait, they're all half siblings to RJ. Like that's so weird.
I don't want to talk about it. It's weird. Honestly, I have to try to not think about it. Because otherwise it starts to feel icky.
Like when everyone has a sibling in common, there might be a little blended, like a blurred line there.
I know. Like, let's try to not highlight that. it's bold and beautiful. That's one of the challenges compared to a lot of the other daytime shows. It is a small pool. Yep. And there's a lot of once removed, adopted, not adopted. it is a twisted web we weave. And so, we do with it what we can, but I'm trying not to think about it. But speaking of RJ, have so enjoyed getting to work with Josh. I mean, he's going to kill me for, I don't know if he will ever listen to this, but he's my little half pint. He's my half pint. That's what I call him. He's my half pint. So same thing, like with Sean, immediate, like he's my little bro. I adore him. He's such a professional. He's handling it beautifully. I'm just excited to create a friendship with him and to work with him. And I'm actually really excited to see how this interaction with RJ and Thomas, like what is going to happen there? Yeah.
Well, on the topic of the Steffi Hope tension, we know that this coming week, Steffi is going to walk in on a little bit of a close moment between Thomas and Hope, where they are seemingly holding hands, which is obviously an uncomfortable situation for Hope to find herself in. So how would you say she handles it?
Spiraling. I think Hope is starting to, like we talked about, that tight grip. That's Hope, that tight grip on the wheel. Got to follow. Like if we're using that metaphor, following the rules of the road, doing everything right. And she's starting to lose that grip on the steering wheel a little bit right now. I adore this character. This is my character and I'm very protective of her. I think it's really interesting to see how she's going to handle this because, that is something she really prides herself on. is having these morals and having these values and doing the right thing. And maybe she's not in control as she thought she was. And maybe, you know, there's more to her, but honestly, the humanity and characters is what makes them worth watching. And it's what makes them interesting. Nobody wants to root for someone that's without flaws. That's not realistic. Every human makes mistakes. Every human says something or puts their foot in their mouth or has these moments that they regret. Everybody living has had a moment like that. And that is what makes characters relatable. So, you know, she might get her, might get her knees a little dirty. She might be messing up. I don't know what's going to come. For me though, what's been interesting is trying to see her resist that and trying to resist this draw. And so I'm curious to see if she does the right thing, but yeah, what she tells Steffi, and it might be a little bit of a spoiler, but you know, they got caught up in the moment. They got caught up in the moment. Okay. You're reading too much into it. We're just excited about the numbers for hope for the future.
That's a thing. That's a thing.
Yes. Absolutely a thing.
Yes.
Well, Annika, since our last podcast with you, I have just been dreaming of the moment that we could have you back so that you and I could have a moment talking about what really matters in life. And that is RuPaul's Drag Race. So I want to know what you felt about Sasha Colby's recent crowning and if you were team Sasha.
I was team Sasha. And first of all, thank you for asking. I am such a fan. I've been watching since like season one. So it is my happy place. And I love that I can essentially watch it year round now because not only is there the US, there's Canada, honey. There is Down Under. There's UK. Like I am just living. I'm so happy. But I was team Anitra. Just because of my little martial arts heart, my like when she walked that duck, I can't say the real thing, but when she walked that duck, I fell in love. That is entertainment. That is a performer. That is a professional. And then Sasha Colby, those were my top two. And I actually think it was a very easy season where everything felt really fair. And I think everything really worked out the way it should have. Those were the top two from the beginning. And those were the top two at the end. And Sasha Colby, I love you girl as well. If not that you've ever listened to this, but just the utmost professional and just as it is such an artist. And you could tell like just so much experience and this groundedness that she brings to everything she does and those performances. I mean, the choreography is just off the wall. So I'm such a fan of both of them and I'm putting it out into the universe. It is a dream of mine to be a guest judge on a show someday. If they ever do a soap opera challenge, please RuPaul, call me. I adore everything you do. And yeah, that's my pitch. So.
I like it. Let's make it happen. Now, as our final question, we always ask this. So is there anything you would like to say to the B&B fans listening?
I would say to the fans, first of all, thank you for being fans and thank you for your support. I know I can't always answer everything, but just know that I'm hearing you and I'm listening over the course of hopefully many years that I will have playing this character. She's not always going to do the right thing. People mess up, people make mistakes. Hopefully they grow from it. And I hope my character, you know, we'll be able to demonstrate growth with grace and learn from mistakes. And I hope you stay along for the ride with me because I'm strapped in there right next to you as well. I don't know where the journey is taking us, but just know I will always try to do justice for the character and bring my all to it. So thank you for everything and just, I don't know, supporting me over the years. And please keep staying tuned.
Love that. Well, I will say this, it was worth the 4-year wait. This has been so much fun. I don't even want to end it, but we have to. So Annika, thank you so much. And everyone should be sure to tune into B&B next week and all the time, but for a very big Hope Thomas moment and pick up a new issue with them on the cover as well.
Thank you. And yes, we have some, you know, little Italian... Some Italian things to look forward to, should I say?
I like that.
Tease a little bit of maybe getting to see some international sights and sounds. So yeah, stay tuned.
All right. Well,
awesome.
We hope to talk to you soon and have an amazing day.
Thank you so much. Thank you both.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Annika Noel for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.